I'd now like to introduce our first speakers, Ian Lachlan and Jared Callaghan, who will be giving an update from APRA's perspective. I've got my speakers mixed up. Thank you very much. My apologies, Adrian. We'll be hearing from Jared later on. And I do have the right bios here, please. Ian's appointed as a member of APRA in 2010, following an extensive career in the financial services industry. He's held a variety of senior management and board positions in a number of major organisations, both in Australia and overseas. Ian became Deputy Chair of APRA on the 1st of July 2013. Adrian's a General Manager in APRA's Diversified Institutions Division, and prior to joining APRA, Adrian worked at ASIC, assessing licence applications for complex institutions and undertaking on-site compliance reviews as part of the implementation of the financial services reform initiatives. And he was also involved in the review and registration of management investment schemes. He's over 21 years' experience as a senior executive. So please now welcome Ian and Adrian.
Thank you and good afternoon. A special welcome to those of you who were at this morning's session. You get a gold star for resilience. And I apologise for the duplication. So here's what we're going to cover today. I'm going to cover the first two sections. Adrian will do the next two, and then I'll finish off with the last two. Let's start at a very high level with LAGIC. So it started well and has reasonably bedded down as well, which is great credit to the industry. So we're feeling reasonably comfortable with how it's gone there. The focus now, of course, is on bedding it down even further and getting the quality up to where we would want it to be, and that's an issue for both APRA and for the industry. ICAAP summary statements are in place, and they're generally okay, but improvements are needed pretty much across the board, and in some cases some significant improvements are needed, and Adrian's going to cover that in quite a bit of detail shortly. Risk management, as you know, we've put a bit of emphasis on risk appetite statements over the last couple of years, and generally speaking there's good progress, but there's still significant room for improvement, and so the message there is that we will continue to focus on that, and so should you. And we are turning our attention to risk culture and risk governance, a much tougher area of risk management, and I'll give you a bit of insight into that in a minute. So overall we're pretty pleased with progress at the moment, so let me launch straight into LAGIC implementation. As you'd be aware, there were a small number of insurers who were materially affected by the new framework, and they received individual transition arrangements. These arrangements were all taken through APRA's internal processes to ensure consistency and appropriateness. At the capital level, the overall capital position, new sort of measures now, of course, compared with the past, but the overall capital position for industry is about 1.95 times PCA at the company level and about 1.78 at the statutory fund level, which is a pretty strong position to be in overall, and interestingly is quite close to general insurance, which is about 1.82. Upcoming areas of focus, I've already mentioned the fact that we are focused on bedding down LAGIC, but we're also doing work to make sure that the capital calculations are done well and that, generally speaking, the quality of the LAGIC work is to a high standard. So that's our emphasis in the shorter term. Lastly, reporting. We collected the first set of reports, of course, at the end of March, and there were quite a few issues there, which are our fault, and we do apologise for that because we know that created some extra work for you. There were a number of lessons in there for us in that as well. We did grant an extension, and generally speaking, the industry responded very well and cooperatively, so thank you for that. Let me now turn to interpretations. Now, this is more of an issue for life insurance than it is for general insurance, interestingly, but LPS 115 in particular is more principles-based than the other capital standards. And it requires actuaries to determine margins for random future event and lapse stresses in setting the capital amount. And there's obviously some potential for variation in the way this standard is interpreted, and we've had some feedback to that effect, and we've been working with a task force from the Actuaries Institute on all of these issues to see what guidance we should actually give, and that will be finalised very shortly for those of you that are interested in that. Okay, so I'm now going to talk about risk management and governance. I'm going to cover these four subheadings. So let me start with CPS 220. And as you know, CPS 220 is the draft, the proposed consolidated prudential standard for risk management. It generated quite a lot of interest, this one, I must say. The important thing to note is that it's largely based on LPS 220 and GPS 220, that is the insurance standards, which have been enforced for a number of years. And much of what's in those standards is actually being applied to the ADI space, the banking world, and not the other way around. We often get comments that we're applying banking standards to insurance. Now, whilst consultation is now closed on this, we are still analysing submissions and formulating a response. So there are some tricky issues that we're working our way through, and I'll talk in a bit of detail about that in a minute. The main new requirements here are, first of all, that you need to have a chief risk officer. That, as a default position, needs to be a dedicated person reporting to the CRO, CEO. And, of course, the CRO, as proposed, cannot be the CEO, CFO, head of internal audit, or appointed actuary. And the last one in particular has generated a bit of interest. There's also a need for, as proposed, an independent board risk committee to provide the board with oversight of and advice on the risk management framework. Let's now go to feedback. And bear in mind, this was issued to all of the industries except for superannuation. So 44 submissions. Interestingly, there were only 4 life insurance submissions. And to contrast that, there were 23 general insurance submissions. Having said that, some of the life insurers would have been caught up in conglomerates, so maybe the response was a bit more significant than is indicated. Now, let's talk now about the CRO, an issue at least for some entities, particularly the smaller ones, was the cost of requiring a dedicated and independent CRO. Now, as indicated in the discussion paper at the time, we are quite open to the idea of exemptions for smaller institutions. I think we should have made it a little bit clearer than we did, but it was there. And so APRA is currently considering this issue in a bit more detail, and we'll give you more guidance. But the idea is that we respond proportionately. Still on the CRO, there's an issue about dual hatting, in particular the appointed actuary and the CRO. There were a number of submissions arguing against our proposals, and some of the arguments, for example, included the fact that the AA was in the best position to assess insurance risk, and the imposition of a CRO might detract from the role of an AA. Now, we believe requiring a CRO to head the risk management function and report to the CEO will elevate the importance of risk management and ensure that it's given the attention that it actually needs. In terms of APRA wanting the CRO to be separate from the appointed actuary, we believe this will encourage an entity-wide risk view. And while we would expect the AA to be the key source for the CRO in understanding insurance risk, the CRO must consider insurance risk along with all other material risks and present to management and the board a clear picture of the overall risk management of the entity. It's not to say the AA can't do that, but the CRO absolutely must be able to do it. And now, the AA will generally be involved in first line of defence activities such as pricing, reserving, capital management, etc. If the AA then serves in a second line of defence role, in part involving independent oversight of the risk management activities, the risk management activities of the first line of defence, a question that can rightly be asked is, how can that AA, acting in a second-line capacity, offer a view on, in effect, the work of the first line, where he or she may also have participated. So, nonetheless, APRA is spending some time considering whether there are any circumstances in which it would accept a CRO also being the appointed actuary. And incidentally, there are a number of examples now of institutions that employ both an appointed actuary and a separate CRO, and in all of those cases, that arrangement is working quite well. Turning now to the Board Risk Committee, under the proposal, there's a need for a separate Board Risk Committee. And the general argument here that we received was that having a separate Board Risk Committee, for example, from the Board Audit Committee, would add little value because the Board Audit Committee could cover the same turf. Now, we don't necessarily accept that argument. Draft CPS 510 outlines different responsibilities for the Board Audit Committee and the Board Risk Committee in relation to the risk management framework. The Audit Committee will review the effectiveness of the risk management framework, so third line, while the Board Risk Committee will oversee the implementation and ongoing operation of the risk management framework in a second line capacity. In other words, if there was a combined Board Audit Committee and Board Risk Committee, there'd be blurring of the second and third lines of defence. And lastly, timing. We had quite a lot of feedback to the effect that 1 January 2014 was too optimistic. And as you probably already know, we have now extended that to 1 January 2015. And in any event, we will finalise our position on all of this by the end of 2013, so there'll be plenty of time to implement. Let's now have a look at risk governance and culture. Now, we've seen quite a lot of improvement in the quality of risk appetite work in recent years. But we'll continue to focus on how risk appetite is embedded in management and board decisions, and insurers, in turn, should continue to give very close attention to this. As mentioned in recent speeches by John Laker and by me, APRA is increasing the attention it gives to both risk governance and risk culture within supervised entities. Effective risk governance is a fundamental requirement for high-quality risk management, and the board's role here is particularly important. The board sets standards and expectations that have a profound influence on the culture and management of the business and on the quality of its governance. And so the board plays a critical role in risk governance. Turning now to culture, which in general terms is often described as the way we do things around here. So for risk culture, you might think of it as the way we do risk around here. For the risk management framework to be effective, there must be a strong risk culture which is consistent with the company's espoused values and its risk appetite. And this clearly starts with the board. Now, that poses a challenge for APRA, and that is, how do we form a view about the quality of risk governance within an organisation, and how do we assess the risk culture within that organisation? We're tackling it on two fronts. The first is that we're enhancing our interaction with boards. So this includes occasional less formal meetings with the chairs of the board and the board risk committee with a couple of people from APRA. So less structured, less formal, a good deal more interaction than we would otherwise get. We've done a few of those so far, and so far they've worked really quite well. The second point is that we are relying on the board's own assessments of risk governance and risk culture rather than doing our assessments. So we're encouraging boards to form firm views and understanding of each of those matters. And to help them along, we're posing, in effect, rhetorical questions for the board to consider. Here are a couple of examples. How does the board satisfy itself that the espoused values are truly supported by management and staff at all levels, and they're not just some nice words on the wall? Does the board have a clear view of the risk culture to which it aspires, and how does it assess the prevailing risk culture? How does the board gain a clear understanding of the quality and consistency of decision-making throughout the business, and is it satisfied that this is driving an appropriate risk culture? The point is, a systematic approach to this will give you much more information than crossing your fingers and hoping. Now, I'm now going to talk about an exercise that we did. Well, we've done it twice now. We looked at it the first time early 2012, and we repeated it early 2013. And we looked at the FCRs, the financial condition reports, and the appointed actuaries' commentary on the adequacy of the risk management framework. And what we did was we looked at quite a few different insurers, and we assessed them against particular attributes. So what I'm about to show you, don't worry too much about the detail. It's the patterns, and I'll explain the patterns to you. Now, first of all, unfortunately, this screen is showing green as blue. So the most of those bluish-looking squares I might refer to as green, and the others are meant to be yellow. So the vertical columns are various attributes that we'd be looking for, commentary on issues that we'd be looking for. The horizontal requirements, the horizontal lines represent an insurance company. Each line is an independent insurance company. What I'm going to do, well, first of all, you can see that there are quite a few greens. That's where we considered that there was valuable content added. Number of yellows, where we acknowledged that there was at least a mention of the issue, and white, there was no mention at all. So you can see there are a lot of gaps and lots of room for improvement. So we met with the Institute, we met with appointed actuaries, we gave them feedback. The Institute itself worked on an information note, and I'll just show you how the pattern compares 1 year later. So I'll just flick backwards and forwards, you can see how it changes. So you can see there's a lot more green, less yellow, and certainly a lot less white. And I think if we did that again today, because of where we were in the process, I think most of those gaps would now be green. So that's really quite good progress and really good to see. But we will continue to keep our eye on this and seek improvements where necessary. So with that, I'll hand over to Adrian to talk us through the ICAP summary statement and our experience there.
Thank you, Ian. I brought my water with me near the computer. I'll be very careful. My throat's a bit scratchy, so excuse me in advance if I cough and sputter occasionally. Okay, ICAP summary statements, or ISSs as I will refer to them. Just want to talk firstly about the process we've been through. Obviously, ICAP is a critical part of the logic requirements, and so we're very interested to see that we have good quality ISSs and how the ICAP process is used in actually running the business of life insurers. So we had a two-phase process. Firstly, we did a very high-level overview of how well the ISS is shaped up against the basic requirements of the standard. The second phase is a more detailed assessment of individual ISSs, including benchmarking against comparable entities. We'll be giving feedback at both entity and industry level, and while not every insurer will be covered in the first part of this process, ultimately all will be. Beyond that, we will start focusing more on how ICAP is used in the actual management of life insurers. That'll happen through our normal supervisory process. We're also thinking about the other crucial part of the logic standard that goes with the ISS, which is the ICAP report. And we're thinking of possibly doing a further benchmarking review of those as well. And if that happened, it will be sometime towards the end of the second half of 2014. Okay, so what were the general findings that came out of our review? These are the general themes that we focused on. The first one was how self-contained the ISS is. There is a requirement in CPG 110 that says the ISS may will refer to other policies and procedures, but will be relatively self-contained. And we think a good litmus test of that is whether or not a new director coming into an organisation could pick up the ISS and from that gain a very good understanding of the capital management process within an organisation. It also needs to be institution-specific enough. I guess there are three key areas we've identified. One is a clear link to the entity's own risk appetite, an explanation of how the risk appetite ties to capital targets and triggers, and finally, how that is all embedded into the operations and activities of the entity. Some of the poorer examples that we saw gave fairly generic explanations of what a risk appetite should say or should contain, or quoted at length from the prudential standards or guidance notes, or gave theoretical explanations of some of these concepts. I guess what we're looking for is entity-specific information to be in the ISS. Alignment is all around how the entity actually implements the ICAAP process in its business, and that will be tested again through our normal supervision activity. But it's important that the ISS tells us enough about how that actually should work so we can test what we see and observe against what the ISS says. Another area was the consideration of statutory and shareholder funds. Many ISSs did not consider these sorts of funds separately from the entity as a whole, and we think that given the way the capital standards work, that is absolutely essential. Integration of all these areas as well is absolutely important, and while there was some variation in detail and quality across entities, it was generally okay. However, one of the aspects we did notice that we would have liked to have seen done better was how all these things actually integrate, and a description of how the process works within that entity, and to explain that clearly in the ISS. Finally, the areas identified as areas for improvement. I don't think there are any surprises in what those areas are, and we're looking forward to seeing how those things evolve. Our review then looked at four broad themes, the first one of which is governance. And the first point around that is the level of board ownership and involvement in determining the ICAAP. And I guess our view is that the better practice ISS would describe what is the role of the board and what's the role of management, how the board is engaged in the process of developing and finalising the ICAAP, and what mechanisms exist for feedback to the board about what's actually going on in practice. So there should clearly be a delineation between the role of the board in its oversight and approval process versus management's responsibility for actually documenting and implementing the processes. Another area was around the clarity of scope and objectives, and the better examples here use things like organisational charts, commentary on the business activities being covered, and using summary tables to, in a group context, for example, explain which entities were covered or not covered by the ICAAP. Again, we found in this case a number of ISSs had generic explanations, such as ensuring that appropriate capital is maintained to meet risk in adverse circumstances, blah, blah, blah. Very generic stuff. We're, again, looking for it to be very specific to the institution. We even had one that actually said it was done to satisfy APRA's requirements, which clearly we would not be happy about. In terms of a forward-looking approach, that's very much also linked to clear scope and objectives. And we think better practice would see forward-looking aims, such as using the ICAAP as a strategic management tool to give further insights to the board and management about the entity's risk profile and its forecast capital position. This also goes to linking the ICAAP with what's actually happening in the business, because not only should the ICAAP inform business decisions, but also influence and reflect the impact of what's happening in the business itself, so that the appropriate capital settings and returns on capital can be achieved. Independent review is an area where there was quite a lack of detail about the process and how it would work. The key requirements here are that the reviewer needs to be operationally independent of capital management and also have appropriate skills to undertake a review. A number of entities talked about using external parties in the initial phase to do this process, whereas others felt their own internal audit teams were adequately skilled. We don't mind either way, but there needs to be some explanation as to how that would work. So what's the purpose of the review? What components will be reviewed and the time frames for that, and also the parties responsible for undertaking the review, or at least the options of who might be considered. And on that point, we certainly can't at this stage conceive of how the appointed actuary will be able to do such a review, because we don't think they will be operationally independent of capital management. Board monitoring and reporting, the final point here. We saw some good examples where a table of what the proposed reports would be, a brief summary of the content, timeframes, and who's going to be putting them together. And indeed, one example we saw, which is a better one, we thought actually had a dashboard and an example of what that would look like in the ISS itself. The poorest example we saw, I think, really had no detail at all and merely referred to other documents and processes. The second broad theme we'll talk about is risk management. And the first one there is the coverage of risk and describing what that actually looks like. And NDIS, of course, is a range of different ways of categorising or identifying risks, although most commonly risks are aligned with regulatory capital requirements. A good example we saw had the entity outlining the different businesses it undertook and the risks that arose from those activities. It then categorised and further defined those risks in more detail, set out how it managed the risks for all those different activities, discussed correlations between risk, and then talked about how much capital was being allocated against those risks. Again, a poor example, just had a very simple matrix listing risk categories but really not providing much detail at all. Probably another thing to note there is that there were some risks that were omitted that we thought would be relevant. A common one was little discussion of liquidity risk. And in other cases, where an entity was part of a group, limited discussion around contagion and other risks that might arise from being part of a group. The second point here is around linking to the overall risk management framework. And most ISSs, we'd have to say, actually did contain a bit of a description of how ICAAP fitted into the overall risk management process and all the policies, procedures and systems that help support that. I guess the better ones we saw gave a more detailed explanation of how all those policies and procedures actually worked in practice and fitted together, and also outlined the reporting, monitoring and governance processes for all of those. Again, harking back to the overall risk management framework. Some also supplemented that with a quite comprehensive list of what those policies and procedures were, how risk management processes have been built into day-to-day control activities, not describing them, but actually just saying how it actually operates, and then also describing how that rolls up into an overall approach. Some of the weaker ones contained insufficient detail to really get a picture of how the overall risk management framework operated, or conversely gave a lot of detail and procedural information that really wasn't helpful. And also, again, the use of generic or theoretical descriptions around how things should work, but no specificity for the entity. In particular, again, where an entity is part of a larger group, some explanation of how that all fits together and how the group-level policies are operationalised or tailored for the particular entity would be very helpful. And finally, the link between risk appetite and capital. And again, good examples here were the risk appetite was quantified and tested against a range of scenarios and possible situations approved by the board, which then actually tells you how the risk appetite translates into capital requirements. The board can then, of course, assess how comfortable that is and make sure that's consistent with its stated risk appetite. And that gives a feedback loop for the board to test those things and also to understand what the capital requirements are and what the parameters and stresses around those might be. One thing we did see was that a lot of ISSs focused on things that directly impact capital, and there was limited consideration of other risks that may not be as directly linked or have an immediate impact on capital requirements. And we think that a good approach there would to describe how the tolerance for those risks actually works in practice. And if it can't be qualified or quantified, rather, there should be at least some discussion around the mitigants and the ability of the NDE to address such a risk event if it actually occurred. The third area we looked at was capital management. I noted earlier around integration that there's scope for ISSs to better recognise and describe how capital decisions drive what the business does, but also how the business outcomes actually in turn affect the ICAAP and considerations of capital positions and capital strength, and that the ICAAP can help make that much, much clearer. Regarding capital targets and quality of capital, the better examples we saw there very much linked to risk appetite, to setting target capital levels and how those levels are then translated into actually articulating the risk appetite. And in many cases, entities noted that those particular aspects were still under development. Most people, of course, express target capital around probabilities of not breaching regulatory requirements. If entities have an economic capital model, they should also talk and articulate how those targets work as well. And the ISS should at least describe at a higher level the approach to determining target capital and, for example, consider each of the risks for each individual fund, determine how much capital will be needed for a certain level of sufficiency over a particular time period, incorporate stress tests and scenarios against that, and then determine what actual amount of capital is needed to be held to reflect that risk appetite. There wasn't always a lot of consideration of either quality of capital, that is whether CET1, Tier 2 capital would be appropriate, nor of specific requirements at stat fund or shareholder fund level. And again, as we said before, we don't see how that can actually work effectively in an ICAP, and we certainly would expect entities to articulate the reasons for a particular mix of capital that they wish to choose. Sourcing and transferability of capital. Some companies didn't really document very well where additional capital might come from. Again, in terms of raising capital, that was often fairly generic. A number of entities also talked about being able to raise capital from other parts of a group. And we would expect that an ISS in that case would describe what's the transfer approval process, how quickly that could occur, particularly in light of possible market conditions or other legal impediments that might be relevant in certain circumstances. And that wasn't always the case. And similarly, if transfers of capital between statutory funds are also envisaged as a source of capital, that also needs to be articulated how that would actually work in practice. Sufficient granularity in looking at trigger levels and actions and so on. I guess there are a number of areas here that we thought were important. Firstly, there should be clarity in describing how specific triggers result in specific actions being taken. What's the impact of all those actions on improving the capital position, including timeframes, and how long board of management expect it will take before what I'll call a normal level of capital capitalisation would occur again. Whether the planned actions are realisable in a very stressed scenario, what dependencies there might be, for example, market conditions, particularly asset markets, and what contingency plans an organisation may have. There's also the necessity to notify APRA in certain situations, and that wasn't always covered off in the ISS. And finally, capital monitoring and reporting. The better examples here gave tables about relevant reporting processes in relation to risks and capital, the timeframes and so on, whereas that wasn't always the case. Finally, area to talk about is stress testing. This was generally agreed to be an area where improvement is required still. Most people talked about a 12 to 18 month timeframe and typically talked about more sophisticated scenarios better tailored to the risk profile of the entity, use of reverse stress testing, and better mechanisms for stress testing outcomes to feed back into capital planning and strategic and business plans. In some cases, there wasn't a lot of detail on the scenarios and methods to be used or how they're actually to be determined in practice. We're not looking for a detailed description necessarily of every scenario, but we want to understand how the entity has come up with the scenarios it has come up with, who's actually involved in that process, and what reporting and approval requirements are around that. The question of sufficient conservatism in levels of stress. We often have discussions with entities about this topic. I guess our expectation is that stress tests have to include a variety of plausible and severe scenarios that, again, reflect the entity's particular risk profile. And, again, reverse stress testing should be part of that. And finally, board engagement. Most ISSs didn't really describe much how the actual process of board engagement works in the stress testing area. In some cases, perhaps understandably, the appointed actuary takes a lead role in determining changes to parameters for stress tests and ensuring that material risks are covered with the board approving that. I guess in a parallel situation, we've been talking to general insurers about how with their catastrophe models, the number that comes out of the model can't be accepted at face value. There needs to be appropriate challenge around whether the model is appropriate and whether the answer that's coming out has relevant judgment and sense checking applied to it. And we would say that stress testing needs to be approached in the same way. So I guess our thought would be that boards have to be fairly well informed of the basis of the stress test scenarios they're looking at in reviewing the outcomes of those and having the opportunity to challenge and discuss with management those outputs, having input into any changes to parameters or scenarios, and then considering what that means more broadly for risk appetite and target capital. And separate to the ISS itself, of course, the board should make sure it documents those discussions adequately. That's a lot of material I've gone through pretty quickly around ICAAP summary statements. The next session I want to talk about is APRA's policy priorities, and as you can see, there are six broad areas I'll be talking about here. The first one relates to the surrender value prudential standard, which was under the Life Act, of course, APRA has the responsibility for issuing prudential standards about determining surrender and paid-up values. The existing standard was issued back in 1997 as AS 4.01, as some of you would probably know better than me. There were some changes in 2002 and 2013. But it's time to do a more thorough review, particularly since 1997 there's been a lot of changes in terms of products such as funeral products. We've got deferred lifetime annuities on the horizon, etc. And, of course, major changes in interest rates, mortality and acquisition costs. So we're currently doing a review of that prudential standard, and our intention at this stage is to consult with industry towards the end of the first half of 2014. Statutory funds. And these, of course, have been a key mechanism established under the Life Insurance Act since 1945. But we actually have little experience or evidence of whether they would actually work if a life company faced a severe stress scenario. So, for example, stat fund assets are legally owned by the life company, but they need to be segregated for the benefit of individual policyholders and particular funds. So in June of this year, we sent a questionnaire out to life insurers with responses due by the end of November to try and identify what practices different companies have in respect of managing statutory funds, how they may differ from each other, whether there are any deficiencies that we might observe. And we intend to compile that information and then determine what, if anything, we need to do next, which could include some sort of good practice guidance. It might include possibly changes to prudential standards if necessary, or even proposing changes to the law. We don't know yet. We'll wait and see what the information tells us. Group insurance. Of course, a topic that's been in the news quite recently. The new prudential standards for RSEs commenced on the 1st of July 2013. That's registrable superannuation entities, for anyone who may not know. SPS 250 is the standard that covers insurance arrangements for RSEs and their funds. And a key requirement there is to have an insurance management strategy and framework, appropriate documentation for the insurance arrangements and also other service arrangements, and the process for selecting and monitoring insurers. And there's also a practice guide for that, SPG 250. But SPS 250 has important implications for life insurers. And we have been doing some work on putting together a good practice guide for life insurers in the group space. It'll talk about what the implications of SPS 250 are for insurers, as well as describing some better practice approaches to pricing, tendering, and general management of group life business. Many of you will be aware we've had some concerns about this area of the market for some time, and it's an area we intend to keep a focus on in the near future. Disclosure. Under LAGIC now, we've introduced some Pillar 3 disclosure requirements regarding prescribed capital amounts and capital bases and their components. And we intend to strengthen these requirements given that we recently implemented some new requirements for ADIs as well, and also to reflect international best practice, or good practice rather, including the insurance core principles. The recent ADI enhancements included a full reconciliation of capital, the features of capital instruments, risk exposures and disclosure around remuneration arrangements. And we're considering the extent to which we should also, in parallel, extend the Pillar 3 requirements for insurers. In addition to that, we consulted earlier this year on potential determination of data that's previously and currently submitted to APRA and whether it should remain confidential as it currently is in some cases. If we were to determine that some of that data is no longer confidential, that would expand the amount of data available to users, as well as improving timeliness and also usefulness of data for industry analysis purposes. It would also allow us to enhance our publications, giving more detailed data for both institutions and groups. We're going to decide, we're still consulting and thinking about that issue, and decide whether there needs to be any more non-confidential data released. We'll make a decision in probably the third quarter of this year after further dialogue with industry. In the meantime, nothing will change. Board support. We're developing what we'll call an information pamphlet for distribution to new and current board members. which is intended to be a concise and plain English view of our expectations of board members in oversight of prudential matters. It'll also include a bit of a stock take of the requirements for boards to assess whether there's any inconsistencies across industries and whether our requirements are appropriate or whether they might be too onerous. So, for example, are boards being asked by us to do too much too often? Or conversely, as linking back to Ian's comments about culture, are they being asked to do the right things often enough? We'll obviously consult with the industry on this before we make any changes, if any. But our motive is really around ensuring that there's good governance processes, not box-ticking, so that boards and supervisors can focus on what's most important. And finally, on attestations, we're doing a comprehensive review of what attestations are provided by boards to make sure that boards are giving attestations of appropriate things, and that if there are things that could be attested to by management rather than boards, we'll look to make such changes. Thank you.
Thanks, Adrian. I'm now just going to talk about some key industry risks. And I'm going to go through these fairly quickly because most of you are well aware of these issues, but they're too important just to pass over. So you might have seen this picture before, and don't worry too much about the detail. It's showing profit margins for disability and death benefits, lump sum and income, group and retail. And you can see there's a considerable downward trend there, particularly those two lines at the bottom, which I think are group disability income and group lump sum is the one just above the line. It's just come down below the line, I think. So clearly, the trends have been there for a while. It's a pretty unsatisfactory point of view from management's point of view, and it's something that we don't like to see, because it indicates poor practices potentially and weak outcomes for the insurers. Speaking of poor outcomes, you are well aware of the lapse issues that are emerging in the industry. There are reasons for that, as you know, and I won't dwell on that. And whilst this isn't a direct issue for APRA, again, it goes to the quality of the business being written and the strength of the business over time. In the group market, which is a lot more topical perhaps than the others. As you know, it's been a very competitive market for a while, and that's manifested itself in pricing and underwriting terms and in operational practices. There have been significant data quality issues. There have been actually some quite poor pricing practices by the actuarial profession, and some skills such as claims managers in particular are in short supply, and the outlook isn't too strong either. So what are we doing about it? Well, we've been beating this particular drum quite hard for a number of years. Adrian just walked you through SPS 250, so that has some direct implications for the way insurers will manage in this environment. The requirement for a claims philosophy is a new one and is going to be challenging for the industry, I think, and it's going to be challenging for the super industry. So one of the things we're saying is that if you're going to offer total and permanent disablement benefits, you need to be able to articulate how you interpret the definition, not just throw up the same set of words as everybody else. That is going to be a challenge, and it's something we're going to pay close attention to. We're having clear and close conversations with relevant boards and management. We've been doing that for a while and we'll continue on it. The good thing is that we're starting to see a change in mindset, in fact a significant change in mindset by both boards and management, so that's a good sign. And lastly, we haven't actually done this, but I think you should take this as fair warning. If we're not content with the way industry manages this issue, or more importantly, individual companies manage this issue, then we may well resort to a Pillar 2 capital adjustment. So there are very few Pillar 2 capital adjustments in the life industry at the moment. This is an area where they could well be applied. I think we could usefully talk more about this in the question and answer session if other people have got comments. Okay, let me turn now to overseas developments. APRA is a member of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, and we're reasonably actively involved in a lot of their activities. In recent years, they've been working on something called ComFrame in particular, and it's intended to provide a common regulatory and ultimately capital framework for internationally active insurance groups. This is really quite difficult and problematic because you've got lots of different countries with lots of different views, and of course internationally active insurance groups by definition operate in multiple jurisdictions. So it's very hard to get alignment of thinking, and the work has been going on now for a few years. It's not likely to drive major regulatory change in Australia because we already regulate groups, less of an issue in life insurance than is in general insurance, but we regulate groups, we regulate holding companies, we have group capital standards in play already, mainly again in general insurance. So a lot of what is being worked on in Conframe, we're already well ahead of the game. Globally systemically important insurers. The IAIS has worked on the systemic importance of major insurers for a couple of years. A methodology was developed. Using that methodology, major insurers were ranked according to their systemic importance. This information in turn then was given to the Financial Stability Board, and they decided that the top nine on this list would be deemed to be global systemically important insurers. Now, I think that top nine from memory are all life insurers or conglomerates, general insurers and life insurers composites. Separately, the Financial Stability Board decided that reinsurers needed closer looking at, and they have asked further work to be done over the coming 12 months. So there are no reinsurers, no global reinsurers in that top nine at the moment. This then all leads to the idea of domestic systemic importance and whether or not in Australia we have insurers who are systemically important at the domestic level. And then a second order question is, if we do, how do you actually assess that systemic importance? The third order question is, what do you then do about it? So at the global level, there are a number of measures proposed for dealing with global systemically important insurers. There's separation of systemic activities from non-systemic activities. There's measures to address substitutability, measures to address interconnectedness, and so on. There's also talk about global surcharges for those particular insurers. We need to think about all of that at a domestic level in due course. It'll probably take a couple of years before we get onto that, but it's going to happen. Lastly, there has been for many years talk of an international capital standard for insurers. There is no such standard at the moment. In the banking world, of course, they've got the Basel requirements. So the FSB, which is populated largely by bankers, looks at the insurance world and says, how come you guys can't put together a global capital standard? They've become a little bit frustrated in the process, and very recently they requested, quote-unquote, that the IAIS develop what they called a straightforward backstop capital measure, which is akin to the banking leverage ratio applicable in Basel, which is basically says that your capital has to be more than 3% of your total assets. So they're saying, FSB is saying to the IAIS, develop something like that so that we at least get that in place, and then they've said you need to have that worked out by October next year. The IAIS has decided that they will in fact comply with that, and so there's a mad flurry of activity to try and produce something. That is also then likely to lead to a capital standard by about 2019 for internationally active insurance groups. So there's a lot of work going on there. The impact on Australia is not going to be huge, certainly not for a few years. We're generally very well placed relative to the rest of the world when an international capital standard is introduced. Because standards are low in many countries around the world, there's likely to be a bit of a lowest common denominator effect occurring. So I don't think any international capital standard will drive up capital requirements here. Happy to talk more about that in the question and answers. So otherwise, over to you, Presenter.